22-60-54, Cedric Ward versus Shelby County, Tennessee. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Durrance and Mr. Leibowitz arguing for the defendant appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it please the court, my name is Jason Durrance. I am here with my co-counsel, Mr. Joe Leibowitz. Together, we are representing the appellant defendant, Shelby County, Tennessee. Your Honors, my co-counsel and I will be dividing both our time and the issues on appeal in our argument today. I will address the summary judgment and release issues. My co-counsel, Mr. Leibowitz, will be addressing the post-trial motions to set aside, alter, or amend the judgments. And we'll also be reserving 2 minutes for rebuttal, if it please the court.
All right.
Your Honors, with regards to the summary judgment and release issues in this case, the county's position is very simple. We believe that this case and the release in this case are governed by both USERRA Section 4302 and this court's precedent in Wysocki versus IBM. The issues before this court today really come down to 2 points. First, we, the county, believe that the trial court erred in denying the county's summary judgment motion for judgment in favor of the county based on the release, and that in the alternative, even if the court finds that the release was not sufficient to have this case dismissed outright at summary judgment, the district court did err by granting summary judgment in favor of the plaintiff on the release issue, such that...
I think there's a fact question there, in other words?
In the worst case scenario for the county, Your Honor, we think that...
There's an interpretive issue.
Correct.
About what does... This is an interesting case.
Absolutely.
I mean, so what does this mean? But then if we disagree with your interpretation, you're saying there's a fact issue about what's better for Mr. Ward.
Absolutely. At the very least, Your Honor, we believe that what should happen today is this court remands... sets aside the grant of summary judgment in favor of the plaintiff and remands for a new trial.
Why don't you, I mean, this is the danger of splitting one count for one party. In the time you have, why don't you tell us about your interpretation? I mean, let's talk about these 2 points, the interpretation first.
Certainly. So in this court's precedent in Wysocki, we believe that the interpretation was very clear. This court used the legislative history, the House report, and the Senate committee report to determine that waivers of USERRA rights are permissible, and they are permissible either through explicit language and release or impliedly through conduct. And now that's really where the district court and Mr. Ward's interpretation of this statute and Wysocki diverge from the county's. We believe that the words and reference to being able to waive a USERRA claim impliedly through conduct means, one, through the word impliedly, there does not need to be explicit language in release, like veteran status in Wysocki.
Yeah, it doesn't have to say USERRA claim.
Correct. We would go further to say it doesn't even need to reference military service or veteran status. And that's because of the second part of the legislative history I just quoted to the court.
Or just the text itself.
Absolutely. Being able to waive a USERRA claim through conduct means that there doesn't necessarily need to be release language at all.
What about this issue, whether the plaintiff had to think that the waiver was more beneficial for him than his USERRA rights?
So, Your Honor, we would say that first, for our proposed interpretation of Wysocki and USERRA as a whole, this notion of a waiver being more beneficial to a plaintiff really comes down to the universal contract interpretation principle that courts don't weigh in on the sufficiency of consideration. Where there is consideration recited in an agreement, here we had $3,000+ in payment that was going to Mr. Ward as part of this release.
The courts don't weigh in, but here there was a legal requirement that, arguably at least, that the waiver be more beneficial than his rights under the statute. So you know, we could argue all day long whether that's a good legal principle or matters of policy, but if that's what the state of the law is, then was the waiver more beneficial than not?
So, Your Honor, I would say that the courts can look to what parties like Mr. Ward himself say initially about the sufficiency of that consideration. Here, by signing the release agreement, Mr. Ward told us, at least initially, that consideration was good enough for him. And Judge Martin,
I'm going to argue that he wasn't properly informed and he never benefited, he never implemented the agreement that he signed because I guess within 2 weeks later he renounced or repudiated the
And that's sign. Where...
And actually, he's got a good argument that the signing of that settlement was not more beneficial because if you look at the verdict that was returned and then eventually returned in the case, that would be pretty good evidence that he was giving away way too much because he was, if you look at the jury verdict that happened down the road in terms of back pay and front pay and everything else, he was waiving his rights for pittance compared to what he was entitled to.
So, Your Honor, I have 2 points to address that concern, a broad one and a specific one. Broadly, and this gets into our argument in the alternative, broadly, when we have a situation like the one Your Honor just described, or perhaps the situation as it exists here, when a party wants to essentially place the waiver at issue, and essentially rescind the waiver as part of the litigation of the underlying USERRA claim, that is a fact question. Judge Martin in his concurrence laid out the potential order of battle, if you will, where the Judge Martin indicated that producing a waiver like the one we have here satisfies the burden of production on the defendant's part. The burden then shifts to the plaintiff to show that that agreement was not as beneficial as his USERRA rights would have been. And so that should be a fact question because, as Your Honor noted here, when the judgment can be, as it was here, over $1 million, no defendant is going to offer their absolute worst case scenario initially as settlement. You know,
just because the red light's on, Mr. Ward had counsel at the time he executed this, made this initial decision, right?
He absolutely did, and that's certainly a distinction from Wysocki, where there was.
I mean, it seems to me we have two questions here. Number one, at what point in time do we make this determination regarding whether one thing is more beneficial to another? And number two, whose knowledge and judgment ought to be determinative? Should it be us post hoc or just us, or should it be the individuals?
So, Your Honor,
Why wouldn't like a week later count though? So here the individual changes his mind a week later. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't we look to that as opposed to the moment he signs?
Your Honor, 2 points to that. The court shouldn't look to after the fact feelings of the waiving party because frankly, buyer's remorse can come up in any settlement agreement.
And so we draw the line, a week, 2 weeks, 10 days.
You know, Your Honor, I believe that in a situation where a party, one, knows of their USERRA rights, and two, has the advantage of counsel, that the moment they sign that agreement, that's when the court should stop looking at the sufficiency of consideration or the sufficiency of the benefits of the release.
All right. I wish we could talk more about this, but we're going to talk about something else or whatever.
Although I know you're out of time, not to prolong this, but is it an issue of consideration or the requirement that whether he was being benefited more by this by waiving his rights or by maintaining his rights? In other words, the legal issue is not couched in terms of contractual consideration.
And I think that that's absolutely part of the problem that the district court's ruling on summary judgment has, Your Honor. I believe the district court said that objectively no jury could find that the $3,000 plus Mr. Ward was offered and accepted could have been more beneficial then the, I believe at that point it was 17 weeks or months of back pay that he was to be, he would have accrued. That's because benefit can encompass more than just the dollars and cents. It can encompass, you know, the party's lifestyle at the time, whether they have other stressors, you know, what's going on in their personal life that they may not want to engage in protracted litigation. That's why the county would submit at the outset that once a party weighs the options and signs on to a settlement agreement, they have done that internal weighing of all of their individual subjective factors for themselves.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joe Leibovich with Appellant Shelby County. Even if the court does not reverse the district court on the summary judgment issue, Appellant does request that the court reverse the district court on its denial of Appellant's Rule 50 motion for judgment as a matter of law.
Let me ask you this. What if, you know, we find there's an issue of fact? Is the county suggesting that we try everything all over again, or do we just send it back to resolve the contractual issue?
It's a complicated question, Your Honor. If you find that there's a question of fact as to the release, that, yes, that could trigger a new trial. However, even finding that, a granting of judgment as a matter of law would have been appropriate in this case in the face of it, based on the fact that plaintiff didn't carry his burden to show that military duty was a substantial or motivating factor in his termination. Realistically, if you find that there's a question of fact on the release, I think you probably do have to remand for a new trial for everything, and maybe you don't even get to this.
Wait a minute. You say that military duty wasn't a factor. The record in the district court seems to be clear that there's an investigation of abuse of these payments. And that the investigation was only directed toward military people who were employees and not the non-military employees. So the record seems to be clear that there were usurer rights that arose because of the detrimental action was directed only against the military reserve or former military people.
I would respectfully disagree with that, Judge Clay, and here's why. First and foremost, the investigation was a criminal investigation by the General Investigations Bureau of the Sheriff's Office, that they would investigate crimes alleged against the community, by a member of the community. It's not like an internal affairs division. It was an independent criminal investigation.
So what? I mean, is your argument that no reasonable jury could find that his military status was a factor in the treatment he got?
Yes, Your Honor, that is our position. And again, here's why.
Real stretch.
I mean,
I don't know if we have other things to talk about, but I mean, okay. You can use your time, although we can't give you more time in this double arrangement.
Well, I do understand that, Your Honor, but it keeps the only, and I won't belabor this, but the point here is that there was a criminal indictment by the state of Tennessee.
That doesn't decide something as a matter of law for purposes of what a jury can decide, and later they drop the charges.
But the policy that was relied on, much as in the Escher case that we cited to, there was a violation of policy. An individual employed by the jail was indicted of a felon for an alleged felony. That's a policy violation. That's not because of the military leave. It's because of the indictment.
But purportedly, only military people were audited. That's a pretty pertinent fact, don't you think?
Respectfully, that's not correct on the record, Your Honor. The audit included multiple employees. The independent.
They were all military people.
No, they were not. It was an audit of the HR office of the Shelby County Sheriff's Office, which included individuals who were not military members. The General Investigation Bureau criminal investigation did focus on military, but they don't make hiring decisions, they don't make firing decisions, they don't make disciplinary decisions.
So you're saying that only the criminal investigation was directed toward military people?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, that proves the point.
Respectfully, Your Honor, we disagree because it's an independent criminal investigation, just as it would be if Walmart alleged this. The argument that just because military leave is in the picture, that it is a motivating factor, can't be the case. If you accept that argument, then anytime somebody is alleged to have fraudulently used military leave, they can't be terminated.
I'm saying a jury could find. I mean, what you're arguing is, if it's as a matter of law, that's enough. That's not the, I mean, this is post-trial. The idea that a jury, no reasonable jury could find this. I mean, I think there are harder questions in this case than this one, really. And, you know, I mean, you guys are getting close to having more than 15 minutes in your total.
I'm going to move on to the issue of whether the case, it was appropriate for the court to award liquidated damages. Here again, we believe that under the Kohler versus Pepsi America's case that we cited, that liquidated damages were not appropriate because there was no indication of a willful violation of USERRA. But most importantly, I want to spend the remainder of my time talking about that the lower court should be reversed as to the issue of altering or amending the judgment. The damages that Mr. Ward should have accrued if he properly won this case should have been limited to those that accrued on or before September 16th, 2016, the date he was to return to work under the agreement that we've talked about before.
To award liquidated damages, the judge had to decide that the violation was willful, correct?
The jury did find that, yes, Your Honor.
And that decision was wrong for what reason?
That there was, for the same, frankly, it ties into the whole argument as to whether there was a violation at all. So I don't want to belabor that issue at this time, simply relying on the mere fact that it was in the picture, that military leave was in the picture, does not show that it was a violation, a willful violation. Here, there was a criminal investigation. There was a follow-up investigation on the administrative side. Much effort was put into this to determine whether or not there was a violation of policies. And there was an indictment by the state of Tennessee. So through all that process, liquidated damages is not appropriate because that is not sufficient to show.
Okay, what standard of review are we supposed to utilize to determine whether the judge wrongfully decided that the violation was willful based on the evidence at trial?
Abuse of discretion, Your Honor.
Okay.
I am out of time. I did not get to address the other issue, but I'll be happy to.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Thomas Gerard. I'm and with my co-counsel, J.P. Schnapper, here on behalf of Cedric Ward, who is here also with us today. I want to hit on some of the harder questions that you asked about first, Judge Cuthbridge, with regard to the validity of the waiver under USERRA. This court very carefully analyzed the two-step analysis that's presented from 4302 in USERRA. 4302A provides that USERRA is the floor. An employer can give a service member greater things and not violate the act.
It doesn't say quite that. It says, you know, benefit more than, well, it does. Well, whatever. Okay, I get it.
Basically, USERRA does not preempt greater benefits.
Well, we know what it says. Yeah. Would you agree that the release need not say USERRA claim and that as just as an interpretive matter, and this isn't about whether it's more beneficial or not, okay, but that a release that says I waive any claim whatsoever ought to be a clear enough waiver of this claim along with any other?
I think what this court announced in Wasaki was that the language of the release needs to be sufficient to inform the service member.
All right, so what appellants any claim whatsoever would seem to cover that. Is that fair so we can like move on to?
I don't believe just the reference to any and all claims. The waiver and release in this case is about 44 words long. It's about as skimpy as you can get when you want to write.
That almost makes it easier. It's not buried in there.
Your Honor, when we look at the case in Wasaki, the release was comprehensive, and the district court said, although it doesn't say USERRA, IBM lists out a very broad range, and that goes through about three or four different statutes. I think they mentioned discrimination rights three times.
You know, he waives any and all claims whatsoever. I mean,
if that had been the case in Wasaki, Wasaki probably would may have been decided differently. That's what I would suggest, Your Honor. I think when we look at Judge Martin's, and I like Judge Martin's concurrence in Wasaki,
which is totally not binding on us.
No, it's not binding, but I think
it's not, you know, a sacred writ either.
No,
I mean,
it's not.
It's important to consider.
It is. I'd like the way he breaks it down, number one, number two. And he says, looking at the face of the document, if it's clear that they declared that they're releasing their rights, and if it's clear that they received substantial consideration, on the face of the document, it's just not enough to determine whether or not that's more beneficial or not.
Okay, so why don't you talk about that point? How do we, why wouldn't we decide this as of the time of the agreement, rather than with the benefit of hindsight? And one concern about the hindsight, I mean, obviously, if we look at the jury verdict,
mm-hmm.
you know, then it wasn't more beneficial. But if that's going to be the test, no military person with a USERRA claim is ever going to be able to waive when, in his judgment, that's better for him in a particular case. There's never going to be a settlement agreement. That person, no matter whether they have a urgent need for money because somebody is sick in the family or whatever, they're never going to be able to enter into a settlement agreement because it's just, it's sort of like when the defense is offside. You just get a free play. I'll pocket the settlement agreement and I'll take you to trial. And if I get more, then the settlement agreement doesn't count. So nobody's ever going to enter into a settlement agreement if we're going to look at a jury verdict and say, there, you know, that's, it shows it's more beneficial. Isn't that, I mean, that's the reality here.
I don't believe that's the reality of this case. And you know, obviously, the jury kind of validated Mr. Ward's concern. You know, 17 months of back pay, lost pay.
So, I mean, you know, the guy you know, it's like throwing the long pass on an offsides play and it's complete. So, okay, well, anyway. You know.
But here, as Judge Clay pointed out, Mr. Ward did not accept this consideration. He rescinded the agreement before he received anything. In Wasaki, the fellow collected the $6,000. In the other two cases, the folks collected the money and they walked away. And then they came back and said, hey.
So that goes to the point in time, you know, more precisely.
Yes.
Is it, but why wouldn't, I mean, if we don't make it the time he enters into an otherwise legally enforceable agreement. I mean, how is it not totally arbitrary to pick some point in time later? Here it happened to be a week later. He had counsel for this decision.
He did have counsel, Your Honor.
I mean, why wouldn't that stick?
If this is a subjective analysis that was argued by opponents on appeal, which I presented, to the court, this was never argued below. This was not presented to the trial court judge. But if it was presented to the trial court judge, there was no analysis whatsoever with regard to the second step. They didn't put on evidence the second step below to the trial court. And it was their duty to do that. And if
second
we're going to.
The second step being more beneficial?
The second step, whether it's subjectively more beneficial or not. They had they had an opportunity and a duty to do that. At motion to dismiss, they sought, and we argued, and the court analyzed all of Wasaki, both steps, one and two.
But we have to interpret the statute correctly.
Yes.
We're not going to interpret it wrongly based on party presentation if that, in fact, was the case in the district court.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm mumbling. We have to interpret this thing correctly. Now, maybe the issue is just not presented, but in your view. But we're not going to say something wrong about the statute just because somebody didn't say otherwise in the district court.
I think, well, the posture of the case is very important, Your Honor. We had moved for summary judgment against defendant's affirmative defense. They have an obligation to present evidence to the trial court as to both steps. And the trial court was very clear that appellants did not adequately address the second step.
Okay,
and that's very clear from the record. If we were going to go back and look to the answer, like what point in time do we make this determination? I think certainly before the consideration is ever accepted by the releasor, all right, that would be a good point.
But I guess, I mean, I understand your point. It's kind of about waiver, and mm-hmm. and I'll take a look at kind of where things stood in the district court about whether beneficial was actually presented to the court. But just let's set that to the side. If we do look at beneficial, why shouldn't the individual be able to make his own judgment at a point in time about what's more beneficial to him, in taking into account all the circumstances, rather than courts deciding that? Because it's not just, as Mr. Durrance said, I mean, it's not just dollars and cents. There are many other circumstances in a person's life that might make them, might make it more beneficial to get a sum of money now. They might have a terminal cancer condition. They're not going to be around in 2 years. Why shouldn't we let the person with more knowledge about what's best for him, namely the service member, why not let them make the decision about more beneficial rather than courts with much less information?
I absolutely believe Mr. Ward is the only person that should be able to waive those rights. And when considering what he did at the time, whether or not he was under duress or not, those are also factors.
So if he makes a decision with counsel to waive the right and take some other benefit now in return, why shouldn't that decide the issue of benefit?
It shouldn't. The question would rather be, did he do so first of all, whether he's aware of his rights, which we argue that he was not.
He had a lawyer.
That's right. And and he was asked in his deposition, you resolved this matter with the county? Well, I wanted my job back. The attorney presented me with the paperwork saying this is what they will do, either take it or leave it. I had been out of work for 18 months, so I signed it. Then a couple weeks later, he says, good morning. It's been almost 2 years. Since I was relieved from the duty of the sheriff's office, blah, I'm not coming back. So in my best interest, I've decided not to return to the sheriff's office. That's what he was thinking at the time. If defendants wanted to make that argument below that at the time that he accepted this release, he knew he was giving him up voluntarily, and he knew that it was more beneficial to him, they should have taken time in his deposition, for example, to discuss with him, what did you think was more beneficial at the time? Why are you reneging on this agreement? Why are you doing this now? They didn't.
Well,
do that.
What I'm suggesting is that as a matter of law, perhaps we ought to be just accepting the decision the individual makes at the time without a trial about whether, you know, they really thought it was best. I mean, they made voluntary counsel decision. I mean, that seems to speak a lot about what an individual thinks.
Well, in the sense that it's a take-it-or-leave-it moment for Mr. Ward.
It usually ends up.
And he reconsidered it? Well, not
there's
not
a point where it's like, beyond this, I'm going to trial.
In other aspects of the law, you know, ADA, there's a revocation period, there's 21 days, there's 7
That's
days.
Statutory. It's in the statute.
Here we have 4302, and I think it's much more powerful, in fact.
What's that?
4302.
Are we talking about the AB thing?
Yes, AB. Yeah, okay. I think B is much
okay, more that's fair.
It very much preempts it. I'm going to switch gears here with regards to the judgment as a matter of law. Appellants hang their hat on the Escher case, which is I think is easily distinguishable here with regard to what actually happened. Mr. Escher was fired from his job for using personal emails over 1,000 times in a short period of time. And in that case, the court analyzed temporal proximity.
He got fired for that?
He got fired for using
that. I guess a lesson to the...
But it's different for the reason the way the court analyzed it.
It's strictly business, huh?
Very quickly, the court went through the Sheehan factors, which are used to analyze circumstantial evidence in these cases, in USERRA especially, and it found there's no temporal proximity because the record was clear that the final decision maker had no idea that Mr. Escher had filed some claims within. The court did not analyze and try to separate out Mr. Escher's military service. At the end of the day, the court said even if he had made a prima facie case, it wouldn't have made a difference because the employer had just terminated another employee for using her email 200 times to sell hats at work. So they would have made the same decision anyways. And they eliminated the motivating factor element. With regard to whether there's a burning question, and it's like, can you get fired for this policy that says if you're charged with a crime? And I think you could, if it was standing alone. And this court has answered the question twice before in Petty 1 and Petty 2 versus the City Metro Police Department. I can't remember the full name. And in that case, they said, if the motivating factor was influenced by an improper factor, then that follows, I don't have the exact quote here, but it follows that the ultimate adverse employment action also is tainted by the same improper investigation. Here, appellants want to focus on the criminal investigation. We've never argued that the criminal investigation, the indictment, the arrest, or any of the horrible things that happened to Mr. Ward because of that criminal investigation were an adverse employment action taken by an employer. The adverse employment action is initiated by Detective Sumner when she only investigated folks who were in the military, who had taken military leave. And going back to the discussion with regard to the what's that?
Counsel on the other side indicated that that the investigation was broader, that it wasn't just military folks.
No, that's incorrect, Your Honor. I'll explain to you. The audit that was taken by the sheriff's office of the sheriff's office leave use included AWOL, sick leave, FMLA abuse, as well as some folks who were identified as possibly abusing their military leave. Mr. Ward was never in that audit. His name was not identified. His name came to the attention of the sheriff's office because Detective Valentine, and remember, I'm not focused on the criminal part, Detective Valentine went and picked all the people that took military leave and plugged them into the investigation. And he picked up that whole investigation and he handed it over to the employment side. Detective Sumner only investigated people who had taken military leave. And that's where it spun out of control for the sheriff's office. If the sheriff's office had taken that audit and gone out, looked at all the AWOL people and all the FMLA stealers and all the sick leave stealers and all the military leave stealers, and then handed that over and then handed that over, and it whittled its way down through the Laudermill hearings and all that good stuff like that, then or Garrity hearings, then we wouldn't have a case here today. But that's not what happened. It's kind of a fruit of the poisonous tree. If the initial employment action only targeted service members, which it did here, clearly the ultimate adverse outcome was influenced in part by his military service. With regard to the issue of willful, very briefly, this is an abuse of discretion. There was some post-briefing notices of additional authorities. We look at the case Thomas versus Broward County. In that case, the issue of willful under USERRA was submitted to the jury after the fact. The judge decided to treat it as an advisory opinion, which it was not. And the court found under operation of FRCP 39 that had been submitted to the jury. In this case, there
draw the line between the regular violation and the willful violation. How do we draw that line?
Well, the jury was asked whether or not the actions were willful, and they received an instruction, no reason to believe they did wrong. But the evidence before the trial was pretty clear that both the administrative employment investigation file included a copy of USERRA. And Mr. Ward, during his pre-disciplinary hearing, which wasn't a pre-disciplinary hearing because this is way after he got suspended without pay, but before he was fired, that disciplinary hearing included Mr. Ward discussing USERRA. USERRA was in the file. He went through every single one of his leave days, proving that he didn't do anything wrong. And ultimately, Chief Fields testified that Mr. Ward was offered his job back because he didn't do what the county said he'd done. And he should not be punished for having served in his military service. With that, Your Honor, unless there's other questions, I think my time is done.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Mr. Ward mentioned his USERRA rights at his pre-disciplinary hearing, as you just heard, and as is stated by the record. He was aware of his USERRA rights at the time of his arrest. He was aware of his USERRA rights at the time he signed the release. There is no question that prior to the time he signed his release, Mr. Ward was aware of USERRA. He was aware that military leave was at issue in this case. Nothing in USERRA has a requirement of magic language for release of claims. Nothing. In Appley's argument, they mentioned the ADA. I think they probably meant the ADEA has a requirement for rescission period. Congress could have required that here if they felt that a rescission period was appropriate in USERRA cases. Congress could have put a requirement in USERRA that there be language that mentions the statute, which the ADEA has through the Older Worker Benefits Protection Act. Congress could have done that and chose not to. So there is no requirement under the statute that a release mention the statute at all. There is no requirement for a rescission period. That being said, when do you judge when an agreement is made? Here, Mr. Ward signed an agreement with advice of counsel. He waived his rights. He doesn't have a right to come back a couple weeks later and say, never mind, I've changed my mind, no deal. There's no authority for him to be able to do that. The release was good. That's why summary judgment should have been granted as to Shelby County in this matter. As for the argument about adequacy, frankly, we believe we did argue the adequacy issue in the summary judgment phase.
Did you argue that, what did you argue about whether it satisfied more beneficial?
We argued that it did because that was Mr. Ward's choice. Bear in mind that this agreement wasn't just about 3 weeks' pay. He was also being reinstated to his job.
Okay.
So that it's that you can't just look at just that small amount of
probationary thing, though, right?
It was I apologize, Your Honor.
That's all right.
It was a 6-month probationary period to the exact same job he had before. If he had gotten past that 6 months, he would have been able to continue. If he had failed the 6 months, maybe he would have had a USARA claim at that time.
What did what did probation mean in as a practical matter there?
The record doesn't reflect that.
Okay. That's a good answer. Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments, and the case is submitted.